Good afternoon. Our council ready?
Yes.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I just want to say that in this particular case, proof beyond a reasonable doubt for the conviction of exploitation of an infirm adult requires the state to show that Mrs. Boyer, because of a physical or mental disability, was substantially impaired and unable to obtain for herself essential services to safeguard her resources and physical and mental well-being. Part of the burden of proof that the state had was to show that an issue with regard to the physical and mental disability can only be done by experts. As stated in the case that I cited.
And is that no matter how severe the disability may be, when does it become obvious to a layperson that somebody is disabled?
I think the observations and that stuff go towards, as Judge Carpenter said, the what your impressions are. I think respectfully, now it doesn't matter what I think, I guess, but I think respectfully that you need an expert opinion, no matter how disabled the person looks, to show that the person, because of that disability, is substantially impaired. I just saw the other night on television Stephen Hawking in Zero Gravity. Would any of us say that he wasn't disabled? But the fact of the matter is he substantially impaired? And the answer is no. And I think our statute, 31, section 3913, says, and Saylor also says, and so does Forrest, that you need to have an expert opinion with regard to disability or physical disability. And then, as Judge Carpenter said, the other part, with regard to substantial impairment, can be shown by lay testimony. So respectfully, sir, I believe no matter what might be apparent, what might be obvious to us, I submit that the burden of proof under the statute suggests there has to be an expert to say that the person was mentally or physically disabled. So, and the reason I say that is because...
Under all circumstances.
Excuse me?
Under any or all circumstances.
I think there are some circumstances where it might be superfluous, but I don't think under these circumstances.
When might it be superfluous?
And the close one might be someone like Stephen Hawking, that he may be not disabled to the point that he is not able to do anything unless he has someone caring for him.
So there is an area where the very nature of the disability makes it self-evident that there is a physical or mental disability.
Yes, but I think there is still a two-part argument in this particular case that wasn't met. That the burden, that the burden of 3913 suggests that there has to be a two-part argument there. Disability, even though it's apparent.
The heart of your position is, tell me if my understanding is not correct, is that the crime in this case, which requires a showing of, that there was an infirm adult, means that to show infirmity, there must be a subsidiary showing of a physical or mental disability.
That a correlating, yes, you're
okay, right. And that subsidiary showing must be proved through expert testimony.
That is correct, and that's what I think Judge Carpenter said, and that's what I think this court suggested in Forrest, because in Forrest,
okay, but you concede that that's not a rule that applies universally.
See, I don't personally think it applies universally. I think it applies.
And you don't, as counsel, think it's applies universally, regardless of what you may think personally.
I think there are readily apparent circumstances where someone, you don't need an expert to say the person is.
And why was not this case one of those readily apparent circumstances?
Because the facts in this case are simply that this 79-year-old woman, to some great extent, had her wits about her, had in fact relied upon advice of counsel for certain things, and was able to pay for her essential services, things that she couldn't do. She may not have been ambulatory, but she had someone take her to and from physicians. She had someone prepare her meals, clean her, bathe her. But she was able, I think, on many occasions to be someone who wasn't infirm under our statute, because I don't think she was substantially impaired.
I'm a little bit confused at this point. I thought that there were kind of two levels that we're looking at, that impairment is defined and means unable to take care of yourself and that sort of thing, and that you agreed that for impairment, lay testimony would be acceptable.
Correct.
To show that this person can't get to the supermarket or whatever else. Okay. But that the underlying question that you contend has to be proven by an expert is, does this person have a physical or mental disability?
Correct.
Okay. And if a person is unable to walk at all, wouldn't you agree that that's something that is a physical disability and that does not require expert testimony?
Yes, but under this statute, no, because we're dealing with an infirm adult. And if you can pay for or obtain essential services for your essential services, then that impairment, that or that disability, is not a violation. You're not an infirm adult, I should say.
Okay, but see, that's what I'm having trouble with, because I think we're kind of shifting between the two levels. Maybe I'm oversimplifying. But you start out under the statute, you say, do we have a person who's over the age of 18 and who has a mental or physical disability? Part one. Then part two, if we have such a person, is that person also impaired?
Substantially impaired.
Substantially impaired. And then there's a definition of what it takes to be substantially impaired. So if we're only dealing with, is this person physically or mentally disabled? I could understand if the issue is this person mentally disabled, that may not be apparent to a lay person. But if the person we're talking about, the potentially infirm adult, is someone who suffers a physical disability such as the inability to walk, why would there need to be expert testimony to establish the disability? And if there's no need for it at that level, I think you've already agreed there's no need for it at the next level, which is the person able to conduct themselves? Are they impaired or not?
I respectfully submit that there are levels, and every person that cannot walk, I don't believe, is an infirm adult.
But wait a second. Is every person that cannot walk physically disabled? Would you agree with that?
Under the ADA, yes. I mean, I understand that. And I have to... Yes.
Okay. So if we have somebody who can't walk, they've satisfied part one, they are physically disabled. Then we get to... what I think is much more the issue, which is this person's disability impairing them, substantially impairing them, so that they need the extra protection of this law, right?
Correct.
And the question of whether somebody is substantially impaired goes to things like, can this person, as you've suggested, pay to have somebody take them to the supermarket or buy their food for them so that everything is fine, even though they can't do it themselves.
Correct.
But again, the problem I'm having is that for that second inquiry, we don't need a doctor. We don't need an expert. We just need a variety of people who can testify that this person can or can't do shopping, driving, bathing, whatever other things on their own.
And the state had that in this case.
Right.
They just did not have the issue with regard to the first prong, the first part, as Judge Carpenter said, the first part being mental or physical disability. In this particular case, the lady was ambulatory. She sometimes had a walker. She wasn't relegated to just a wheelchair. She was ambulatory also. In this particular case,
You're saying she had no physical disability?
No, I think it's degrees. Yes, she had physical, she had a disability. I mean, but I don't think it was by statute the disability that made her infirm. She had a disability. She was more likely than not to rely upon a wheelchair as opposed to being able to walk around without aid.
Was there a bill of particulars in this case for the state to identify the physical or mental disability it relied upon?
No.
At trial, was it clear what the state contended was the physical or mental disability that was the element of infirm adult?
I don't believe so, and that's why I held my breath, as I mentioned to Mr. Wakely, to see when the other shoe would drop, because the state I submitted throughout was relying upon some mental infirmity, some dementia sort of argument that they brought out, elicited from a layperson. I thought they were going to close the circle with a physician to indicate that that was a mental disability, and therefore the correlated observations would show that she, Mrs. Boyer, was in fact in
their Rule 16 discovery, and they said,
absolutely open discovery.
It so was they said there was no expert. You knew that up front.
No, they had an expert.
Oh, so there was disclosure of a doctor.
They in fact, the doctors were listed. They just never called them.
Let's see if I understand your position. In response to questions by Justice Berger, you conceded, I believe, that the substantially impaired element of the crime doesn't require expert testimony.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you also conceded that if the victim or alleged victim is physically disabled, that determination doesn't require expert testimony in and of itself.
Yes.
But your contention, if I understand it, is that even though Mrs. Boyer was physically disabled, that physical disability is not what caused her to be substantially impaired. Is that right?
That there was no proof that that's what caused her to be substantially impaired. That if the state and the state had an opportunity to either rely upon physical or mental disability, I believe the state chose the road of mental disability because they elicited the issues of dementia, the onset of Alzheimer's, and things like
that. Okay, so the state's theory did not rely on the physical disability, and there was no effort to show a causal relationship between physical disability and substantial impairment. If I understand the way the argument runs, the conviction could only be predicated on a mental disability, which would require expert testimony that wasn't adduced here, correct?
Yes, but I also believe that there, even some physical disabilities, you may need an expert for that prong, that particular element, that part. But in this particular case, the evidence
in
of the
state... In
this
particular case, you didn't, because Mrs. Boyer couldn't walk. And I think that in response to Justice Berger's question, that made her physically disabled.
No, but she couldn't... She was ambulatory. She could walk. I mean, there were times that she would take a walker, and come in. We had three videotaped interviews with her. And the thrust of the state's case...
Is it relevant or not to this case that she had a physical disability?
Yes, it's relevant. I don't think it's what the state relied upon.
Did the instructions clarify whether it was mental or physical?
No. I've asked for 5 minutes to sum up. Let me just briefly suggest to you all that the Sailor Court, I think, got it right in that an issue concerning whether an infirm adult suffered from a physical or mental disability, notwithstanding what I've said here, is a matter properly addressed only by experts. And the court then went on to find that there's no authority, nor does this court believe that it is logical to require that the substantially impaired part of the statute be established by experts. Thank you very much.
Let me, before you even begin, ask, you had an expert and then didn't bother calling them? What was the thinking on that?
Your Honor, I was not familiar that we had an expert that was provided to Mr. Liguori, so I can't address that specifically. I was unsure who they called or what was what went on with that. I don't believe it's in the record in any way that we had an expert and chose not to call them for any specific reason.
Well, all right, let me go to the next one, which is assuming for the moment that someone who has a limitation on their ability to walk can demonstrate that to anybody's satisfaction and therefore establish that that person is physically disabled. Let's just start with that assumption. If we're talking about a mental disability, it's much more difficult, wouldn't you agree, to rely on people's observations who are not trained in the field to say, oh, this person has some sort of mental disability.
Clearly, in most cases, Your Honor, in a prior life, I did commitment work over at Delaware State Hospital, and in many of those cases, you probably would not need an expert to have someone to show that someone had a mental disability.
Well, I think people perhaps have their own ideas of what somebody who has a mental disability would say or do that would, you know, clearly demonstrate that disability. But in this case, we're talking about somebody who was not raving mad, aren't we?
Certainly not.
Okay, so we're talking about somebody who the state alleged and tried to prove was suffering from forms of dementia, correct?
No, Your Honor. I do not believe that that was the basis for the state's case. In the state's opening, the prosecutor argued that Ms. Boyer was physically unable to get around. The only reference to dementia was from the victim's sister, who testified that particular word, dementia, was not specifically elicited from Ms. Taylor. The record shows that no questions were directed in that way, specifically towards dementia, with any other witness.
I thought Crystal Marenberg, an investigator with Adult Protective Services, testified that the alleged victim was unable to recall the day, date, or year. And if so, my follow-up question on that is, isn't that the type of inquiry that a doctor would use to determine whether someone has, in part, to determine whether somebody has a mental disability?
I believe the mini mental examination that she used is a first step in assessing dementia. It's also a diagnostic tool that Adult Protective Services and their workers will use whenever they go out on investigations just to determine who they're dealing with.
Is dementia a medical diagnosis?
I believe so, Your Honor.
And that was argued in the case?
It was not specifically argued by the prosecution, Your Honor.
In closing, it was not
argued? I don't believe so, Your Honor.
All right, so let's pursue the other tack. Is it the state's position that because Ms. Boyer had certain physical disabilities, that in turn led to her being infirm in that it created an inability to perform essential services or have them performed for her?
Yes, Your Honor.
Maybe I'm confused here, but if a person is confined to a wheelchair, let's say, but is mentally sharp as a tack, you know, they were in an unfortunate accident and can't walk. So that person now has pays to have somebody bring them groceries and even cook their food for them and help them with toiletries and hygiene and things like that. Is that person an infirm person because they have to get somebody to assist them with those things?
The state would argue yes, Your Honor, or else the wealthy would never be able to be exploited. The fact is that Ms. Boyer was paying in excess of her monthly income for the assistance that she received from Ms. Custis. She was unable to cook for herself. She was unable to clean herself. She was unable to go to the bank, to the doctor's office. Ms. Custis provided her medication, though Ms. Custis did suggest that she would be able to understand when she had to take certain things.
Okay, well, let me go back to the statute, I believe. It says substantial impairment is the inability to perform or obtain for himself or herself essential services. Now, granted, Ms. Boyer could not perform the essential services herself because of her limitations. The fact that she couldn't perform them, though, wouldn't make her an infirm adult unless she also couldn't obtain those services for herself. Isn't that correct?
I believe so, Your Honor.
However, if somebody's very wealthy and can pay to have all kinds of people taking care of all of their needs, are they infirm adults?
The state would argue yes, Your Honor. And using the example of Stephen Hawking, it's hard to argue that he is not an infirm adult. Without the amount of money that he has, without his wealth, he would die. He would be absolutely unable to obtain those things necessary to sustain his life. And in this case, Ms. Boyer was unfortunately using in excess of what she earned per month to pay for these services. There would have come a time where, had she run out of money, and with the Bennett's use of her funds, she quickly would have, that she would not have been able to pay to obtain these services anymore. Ms. Custis was not there as a volunteer. She was there as a paid employee, paid in excess of what Ms. Boyer earned per month.
Mr. Wakely, let me just make sure that I understand your position. Is it the case that the state's theory of guilt relied exclusively on the proposition that Mrs. Boyer was physically disabled?
Yes, sir.
And not mentally disabled?
There was no substantial evidence that she was mentally disabled at the time of these occurrences.
And that wasn't argued to the jury?
I do not believe so, Your Honor.
Yet there was presented to the jury testimony, lay testimony, by Catherine Taylor, the sister, Ms. Boyer suffered from dementia, possibly secondary to also from Alzheimer's. And there was other lay testimony that at least was consistent with that drift. So,
to the extent, Justice Jacobs,
I mean, the jury was exposed to this testimony, even if it is the case, as you argue, that that testimony wasn't channeled through a legal argument that was presented to the jury.
Yes, Your Honor, but it wasn't objected to at the time. There was no opportunity if that testimony was improper, and the state certainly does not concede that it was, to correct the jury's impression. The state's theory of the case was that Ms. Boyer was physically infirm and physically incapable of obtaining for herself the essential services necessary to sustain her life.
And she was unable to obtain those services because even though she was obtaining them, she was spending more money than she had to do that?
Yes, Your Honor. She would have been unable to obtain these services if she had for very long.
Was the was there an argument at the trial court level that the case, the state's case, should be dismissed because the expert testimony was essential?
I believe it was at in the motion for judgment of acquittal.
All right, but it didn't take the form of objection to the lay testimony that alluded to Ms. Boyer's mental condition.
Not at the time that the. Not at the time the testimony was elicited, no.
Well, just so that to put it into focus, Mr. Liguori's reply brief says the state improperly argued at trial that Ms. Boyer suffered from dementia when they knew that they had no medical testimony to establish that fact. And you're telling us that that's not so.
That is the state's contention, Your Honor. The basis for the state's case was physically unable, physically infirm.
Apparently the summations are not in the record, or in the appendix. And Mr. Liguori has made no record citation to his contention either. So it would be helpful to have some citation.
Your Honor, I can only cite to the state's position in the opening. As you've noted, the transcript of the closings has not been presented. But it, as to the state's theory, it's in B9 of the trial transcript. Your Honor, it's fairly clear that there are a number of physical manifestations that lay people can testify to, and Ms. Boyer's physical limitations were clearly manifest to those around her. She was brought from a nursing home to the Gordon's home, to the Gordon's home, then brought back to a nursing home, then brought to the Bennett's home, then brought back to a nursing home. The testimony at trial was that she was unable to drive herself. That came from Catherine Taylor. That came from Rosie Custis. She was unable to cook for herself. She was unable to get to the grocery store on her own. These are physical manifestations that were obvious to those around her. And it is the state's contention that that was sufficient to establish that Ms. Boyer was physically infirm within the meaning of the statute.
Was there record support for your contention that she was spending more money than she had? In other words, did the evidence come in to establish how much each of these services cost and how much money she had to pay for those services?
I believe there was, Your Honor, and I believe I cited to it specifically. If I may have a few moments
Sure.
to just review my brief. On page 9 of my brief, Custis was paid $450 per week by Boyer to care for her. At the time, Boyer received income of approximately $1,000 per month, and the citations to the record are provided inside.
Well, if she's getting $1,000 a month and paying $450, she's got enough money to pay for those services, right?
Presumably at the time, Your
Honor. Can you tell us, the legal context of the appeal is the denial of the motion for judgment of acquittal for lack of expert testimony.
Yes, sir.
What did the Superior Court judge say? Denied, or did he give an explanation?
I'm unsure, Your Honor. I apologize. I believe it was simply denied.
That's not in the appendix either, is it?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. If the court has no further questions, the state will rest on its brief. Thank you, Your Honor.
Can you tell us what happened, what the Superior Court judge said, and give us a citation for your position that the state did argue that the victim suffered from dementia?
Yeah, I can. I was the trial attorney, and I can tell you that the state's case, as it developed, they brought people like Pete Perego, Christine Merriberger, an attorney by the name of Carl Haller, another attorney by the name of Vincent Vickers, to suggest that Mrs. Boyer mentally didn't know what she was doing with regard to didn't know what she was doing with regard to changing the codicil in her will, with regard to giving a mortgage to the Bennetts in favorable terms. It was respectfully, it was the state's case, the thrust of the state's case was that she was mentally disabled. With regard to your question to me, the trial judge ruled against my motion. I asked for it. I asked for a judgment acquittal at the end of the trial, saying, you know what, we just had this diagnosis, this term of art, dementia, brought here in front of the jury, and the state hasn't closed the circle. And he said that my motion was denied. I then, at the end of the case, prior to sentencing, refiled my request. He denied it, and in fact said he would have found them guilty if it was a court trial.
Is this in the record?
It is in the record.
Is it in the appendix record?
It's not in the appendix record. I apologize. It is in the record. I just want to ask the court to consider that mere physical and mental limitations do not make one an infirm adult under our statute. That there has to be a correlating connection, a nexus between mental or physical disability and substantial impairment. Justice Berger, in your reading of the statute, I submit that when someone, because of their disability, is able to obtain for him or herself essential services as defined in 39024, they are not infirm adults.
Well, what about the fact that this person didn't have enough money to obtain those services?
There was evidence in the record that she was going to be taken care of for her life by the Bennetts. There was a contract that was drawn up between the Gordons, the daughter and son-in-law of my clients, and Mrs. Boyer, that they would take care of her for her life, no matter what the expense.
Well, but the statute talks about being able to obtain those services for yourself. And the situation you're describing here may very well be exactly what the statute was designed to protect against, and that is somebody who does not have enough money to take care of his or her needs because of the physical disability, and therefore can't provide for themselves, which then in turn makes them susceptible to someone taking advantage of them and saying, don't worry about the fact that you can't pay for this, I'll take care of you.
And I agree with you, and I'm telling you in this particular case, there was a contract drawn up, drafted, and signed. I will also tell you that there were...
Is that in the record?
Yes, it is in the record. And the contract's in the record, too, as a matter of fact. And also, there were levels of attorneys involved in this case because the state's theory all along was that Mrs. Boyer, could not mentally appreciate the financial aspects of what was going on. If you see the letter from Marienburg, if you see Ann Riley's
Mr. LaGuardia, but you said that twice. That is, you've asserted that the thrust of the state's case was reliance on mental disability. The state disputes that.
I know.
Where in the record do we find out what the state's case was?
I think the way witnesses unfold and what the witnesses were used for by the state.
About what the state argued formally.
I don't think you can. Well, let me answer it this way. I don't think there's anything in the record that suggests that she was just physically disabled. The record shows through Perego, through Marimar,
well, I understand
through
that.
Everyone.
I understand there was evidence that alluded to mental disability, but my question is, did the state formally argue mental disability, or what, is it the case, as counsel for the state argues, that the state relied solely on physical disability?
Okay. And my answer, sir, is, I apologize to the court, I don't recall completely, but I do know we argued mental capacity in our summations.
Are they transcribed?
I'm embarrassed to say I thought they were, but I don't know. I mean, I can check. I thought they were, because that's what I asked for, the entire transcript from beginning to end, including the sentencing. And I thought they were.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take this matter under advisement. Take a brief recess.